Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. The teacher with whom we have the closest relationship is our heart. So as we live our lives, we need periodically to ask our hearts, am I living a good life now? Anyone can hear his heart speaking to him. If a person hears the sound of his heart tearfully sobbing, then he needs to stop immediately whatever he is doing. Anything that makes the heart suffer will ruin him. This excerpt is by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon in his autobiography, As a Peace-Loving Global Citizen. In 1954, Reverend Sun Myung Moon founded the Unification Church, officially the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity. In this millennium, Reverend Moon and his wife, Dr. Hak Jahan Moon, founded the Universal Peace Federation. It is an organization that has grown to worldwide status and works very closely with the United Nations. Joining us today on the Godspeed Institute is Dr. Thomas G. Walsh, President of Universal Peace Federation International. Thomas, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Carol, or may I call you Care?
Care is fine, thank you.
Okay, good, and I thank you and the Godspeed Institute, and appreciate not only being on the program, but the good work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. Now, so much has happened in the course of the past 50 years. Reverend Moon's founding of the Unification Movement following World War II, its rise to public consciousness and culture in the West in the 1970s, perhaps the best place to start is the beginning. I wonder if you wouldn't mind, please, sharing about Reverend Sun Myung Moon, about his life and experience.
Sure, I'd be glad to. And I appreciate very much the quote that you read beautifully from the autobiography As a Peace-Loving Global Citizen, which I think is a very good source that information about which is on our website. But as you said in the intro, Reverend Moon was born in 1920 in what is now North Korea, town of Jeonju in North Korea. Korea was known as the Hermit Kingdom, at least from the perspective of the West, shall we say. And yet at that very time that Reverend Moon was born, in the context into which he was born, was the period of Japanese colonial occupation of Korea. We know the Japanese through Pearl Harbor and the Pacific War during World War II, but
right.
Early in the 20th century, the Japanese expansion had already begun. Reverend Moon's own family was deeply involved in what is called the independence movement. One watershed moment in that history was 1919. And, you know, Reverend Moon grew up knowing about his family's involvement in that independence movement, particularly one uncle, a granduncle, Yeonguk. He had been educated in seminary. So this Japanese background was critical. Reverend Moon's family life was very traditional Korean, you might say infused with, of course, Oriental values of importance of family, but and this was also intermixed with Confucian culture and ethics, the spread of Buddhism in Korea, but also Christianity that became very strong, and Reverend Moon's family was converted to Christianity. In 1941, he studied in Japan. He studied electrical engineering But his real passion was religion. And when he was very young, approximately 15 years old, he had an overwhelming spiritual experience, a direct encounter with Jesus, who kind of anointed him to, in a very powerful way that I would say was kind of like the defining moment of his life course and passion and sense of mission to carry forward Jesus' own life work and dedication. So that was around 1935. He's had a very challenging life. He did seek, in a very difficult environment, first the colonial Japanese rule that was quite severe on Korean people, and there's kind of a, we know the problems in racism in America and the black-white problems there. You could draw an analogy to the way in which Japan at that time treated the Koreans. And and then following that, you have, of course, World War II. The good news is that Korea is liberated from the Japanese after the surrender of the Japanese in 1945.
The bad news.
You know, we kind of began the Cold War at the same time, and you had a division of North and South Korea, and the North, which is where Reverend Moon's hometown is, became dominated by a virulent, militant form of communism under Kim Il-sung and backed by both the Soviets at that time and the Chinese. So he was imprisoned because there was no religious freedom. Pyongyang had been a very religious country, but it was now all religious voices were suppressed. He was imprisoned in Pyongyang, which you know of as the capital of North Korea. He was then put into a what's called a kind of a labor camp, kind of a Solzhenitsyn-type, gulag-type of communist camp in a place called Hungnam. 1950, the Korean War comes. It's just devastating for Korea.
Yeah.
So this is the environment. You mentioned in the course of the Korean War, he was liberated by the 16-nation UN peace force that allowed him to escape death in that camp, and he relaunched his ministry right there in the on the battlefield of the Korean War.
Well, you know, Thomas, if I may interject, the scenarios you've presented so far make me feel that Reverend Moon is actually a person who can relate to many, many people around different parts of the world in his experience, in the many diverse challenges culturally, spiritually, just across the board.
Yes.
And now you say he relaunched his ministry. What were his goals then as a minister?
Well, the first institutional expression of his goals, I would say in a nutshell, what is the goal within kind of using Christian language, we'd talk about building the kingdom of God, that the world should manifest the true love and character, personality, and aspirations of God. And he didn't see that in the world, and many of us see that the world that we experience is in great dissonance to our ideals and aspirations for a world of peace and love.
And
that's the kind of guiding guiding principle or ideal, how to bring about a world that would be an expression of the God that we know and believe in and that we associate with attributes of love and compassion and wanting to see human beings flourishing everywhere. So that's kind of the guiding principle. So he could see communism as a problem, anti-religious, militant atheism and materialism. He could see colonialism and kind of Asian at that time through the Japanese at that time, a kind of a fascist movement comparable to the Nazi movement virtually
right.
in Europe. He saw that. Then as he observed religion, he didn't find just the shining bright light of purity and goodness and no self-interest, but selfless service to others. But when you're missionary territory, you start to see the fissures within the Christian family, between Catholics and Protestants, but
right.
denominationalism, so to speak, and could see a certain kind of competitive lack of what we call ecumenism or mutual respect and cooperation. So he started something called the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity at that time, kind of an ideal of a supra-denominational or meta-denominational movement.
Right, or almost going back to the pre-denominational church,
yeah,
back to the beginning. Sometimes I find we need to go back to the beginning to move forward.
Yeah.
Right. You know?
That's right. And this, of course, generates a lot of misunderstanding. What's he trying to do? Who does he think he is?
Mm.
Another aspect of religions, as many of us religious people, we kind of have a bad habit of shooting ourselves in the foot and...
Mm-hmm.
There's a sad history where the attitudes of one religion toward another throughout history have left much to be desired and often has been led to bigotry and persecution and mischaracterization, misrepresentation. And you can find it virtually in any religion. You can talk to people of a religion, and it doesn't just have to be a smaller or newer or minority religion, but even mainstream religions feel that they are not represented fairly or accurately. In fact, they're vilified and
right.
misrepresented. Muslims feel that by the West and Christianity.
Right.
Catholics feel that restrictions through health care policies that force them to prescribe birth control or cover the costs, are an invasion.
Right.
So there is a lot of disharmony and discord among even the communities that seek to build a world of peace or establish the kingdom of God. And this was surely been... one of the hallmarks of the Unification Church history. It has been called cult.
Yes.
And Reverend Moon a heretic, or that he is using religion to serve selfish goals or whatever. And, one could plug in any religion into the blank on the page and find that Mormons were once called that, or
right.
Jehovah's Witnesses, or Buddhists in America, or this particular sect of Buddhism, the Nichiren group is that way, and the Unification Church surely has had its share of that. I can remember in particular in my own course, I joined the Unification Church in around 1975, and I think it was around 1979 in the fall that this horrible incident in Jonestown, Guyana occurred.
Right.
The Bill Jones or whatever, and there was this mass suicide. And this became the archetypal end game for all newer religious movements. So it was a terrible time to be outside of a mainstream religious tradition, and the cult, anti-cult kind of
misconception
hysteria
yeah.
grew. And in many ways, that left a lasting impression, unfortunately.
Well, I might agree, because, you know, to this day, those of us who think back or who discuss it, but looking back at the 70s, you know, the word Moonies was
right.
the kind of nickname, and people remember mostly images of the, like, the mass weddings.
Right.
But, you know, here in the West, perhaps did not look into what was actually the motivation.
Right.
So I'm interested to hear then about how the Moons as a couple continue to work and create new organizations once again, like Universal Peace Federation. What led to the development of UPF?
Well, it's definitely an outgrowth of the religious and spiritual vision, and Reverend Moon's understanding of God, first of all, is that it is an understanding of God, that God is not just this being outside of history who is indifferent to or entirely all-powerful, and everything is happening in this world exactly and precisely according to God's will. But on the contrary, that God created human beings and gave human beings free will and gave guidance and the word, so to speak, as the guidance, but that human history has not, beginning with what many religions teach about as the fall or the break away from God, that in Reverend Moon's understanding, God was shattered and disappointed at the deepest level and hurt, like a parent would be who sees their beloved son or daughter doing something terribly self-destructive, or seeing their own child killed. This is the kind of sense that God, when he sees war and misery and poverty and suffering, is a God who longs to see that changed and is looking for people who can be agents of change and transformation. And so that's kind of drives Reverend Moon, that he feels what he calls the heart of God. And the heart of God is not a self-satisfied God who is unmoved by human suffering, but on the contrary, a God who is virtually grieving at the, just as you or I or any conscientious person would look at history and what's going on and feel sadness and grief, God has that to a higher degree than we do. So that kind of is what is the animating spirit and drive that even this man, he's 92 years old.
Wow.
He doesn't rest. But you're right. He started the religious movement, rooted in the religious vision, but he's never been interested in, and you see this in the autobiography, and just the kind of traditional church box or compartment. Although that is the root and core, he sees that these spiritual principles that are cultivated and taught through religious, more specifically religious institutions, churches, temples, mosques, synagogues, that they become infused in all sectors. So he has worked to form organizations in the arts, and seeing that arts and culture can be instruments of peace,
yeah.
of love, of goodness, or they can be very destructive, and they can in a mighty and powerful way influence people and shape them and form opinions and kind of guide them in very destructive ways. So he's been a strong advocate of the arts, but seeing how can we kind of turn artistic creativity in all its various forms into the service of God. And not just in some kind of holier-than-thou way, but full of dynamic creativity, but still educating in a constructive way.
I wanted to just say something about the arts there. It's also a way to build a bridge because the arts cross over all the boundaries.
That's right.
You know, music, art, everything we can create of that nature brings people together as well.
Exactly.
Now, I know that one of the principles of the organization is unity, and it says that peace comes through cooperation beyond the boundaries of ethnicity, religion, and nationality. So what does this mean now for this organization that Reverend Moon has moved from the perhaps strictly Christian arena now into the world arena and multicultural and multi-faith entities?
Yeah. Well, two things immediately come to mind. And one of the points go back to you referred to the mass wedding or mass marriages. And this is kind of a flagship trademark of Reverend and Mrs. Moon. Their term they use is the blessings, and that comes from the text in the first book of Genesis that's talking about the three blessings that God gave to Adam and Eve to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, take dominion of all things, but that God wants to bless, and particularly in marriage, that through there is a complementarity rooted in the cosmos, the world, that marriage can bring together this yin and yang and masculinity and femininity to create a whole. And that if this kind of ideal of God's love, and even, if you will, the kind of incarnation of God, is not in the holy sage in the desert in isolation, but it's really in the couple. So Reverend and Mrs. Moon are referred to in the church as true parents. This kind of position of a couple that complement one another and embody the true love of God. So this is a central teaching, and also that marriages and families should not just be about my personal happiness, how I can experience joy with Mr. Wright or Miss Wright or something, although that's important and that's part of it, but how as a family do I live a life of public service for the sake of others? So one of the areas, and this comes to your point, that Reverend Moon has advocated and has been controversial, he has strongly encouraged intercultural, international, interreligious marriages. And many of these blessings are mass marriages, as they're called in the popular media, were between people of different nationalities and religious backgrounds. For example, he initiated blessings or encouraged Koreans and Japanese to intermarry. This was anathema to many. It was also many Americans to Japanese, and parents of sons or daughters of the World War II remember the Japs, as the enemy.
Right.
But kind of the theory is that one of the ways, and this is strictly voluntary, nobody's kind of, but it's an encouragement that the practice of interracial, international, intercultural marriage becomes a kind of symbol and sign and expression and manifestation of the possibility to establish true love at the deepest level, not just through shaking hands or being in the same room together or even praying together, but actually living together, sharing the bedroom, raising children who don't know whether they're Japanese or Korean or can't say, I'm both. I'm, you know, the sum is greater than the parts.
Exactly, so like a new creation.
That's right.
We're about halfway through the program, Thomas, and when we come back from the break, I want to continue discussing God and the role of family and marriage and love. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we will continue our conversation with Dr. Thomas G. Walsh, President of Universal Peace Federation International. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Seal. Stay with us.
Now's the time for stepping out of place. Get up on your feet and give account of your faith. Pray to God or something, or whatever you do. What I see can make me stop and stare. But who am I to judge the color of your hair? Surely y'all are feeling much the same as I do. We got to keep this world together. Got to keep it moving straight. So the people can relate. If you're rolling to your left, don't forget I'm on the right. Trust and forgive each other. A little love and we just might. Thinking of the troubles of today, is it easier to put that gun away? Or is it difficult to stop the world and show that you care? Everything and everyone we know is beautiful. Surely you will be the guiding light to save us all. Maybe we can be the vision of a prophet man's dream. Gotta keep it moving straight. Love like we mean forever. So the people can relate. If you're rolling to your left, don't forget I'm on the right. Trust and forgive each other. A little love and we just might.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking with Dr. Thomas G. Walsh, President of Universal Peace Federation International. Now, in the first part of our program, we were discussing Reverend Moon, his earlier life and sufferings and vision and founding of the unification movement in Christianity, and moving on now. He and his wife also founded the Universal Peace Federation in 2005. And we were just discussing some principles of the organization. Thomas, I know that the primary principle is God and that we are one human family created by God. And another is spirituality, which is deemed the highest quality of the human being. Spirituality and morality. And a lot, then, is also rooted in family. Family is the school of love and peace.
Yeah.
Can you please share more about family, about marriage and about how, quote, love must have a partner?
Yeah, thank you for asking that and underscoring that area of work, because it's critical. And, you know, I think we do tend to see the West as leaning more towards a more individualistic type of understanding of life and society, and Asian culture perhaps owing in part to the Confucian family ethics emphasis, but whatever the roots and origins of it, that Asian civilization has a more family-centered culture, and certainly that's part of Reverend Moon's core vision and teaching. The phrase that we often use, taking from his own words, is that the family is the school of love or the school of peace, that before we enter any classroom or even are socialized into the wider society by peers and others, we get our most fundamental core attitudes from our parents at the very earliest, even the prenatal period of life and the early days and weeks and months of life are decisive in the formation of character and even aspects of intelligence and certain attributes. And social science developed primarily and not exclusively now, but early on in the West, underscores this point that the family is critical for the kind of psychosocial development of children. But also that it's really this environment of love that is most critical and that can be most powerfully manifest and conveyed and communicated, not only linguistically, but just by the environment and harmony of the household. So the family becomes the cell of the wider society. It multiplies, you know, even thinking about, you know, Reverend was always teaching about Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and the biblical history, which very much is tied to these deep family relationships, Jacob and Esau, and Abraham and Sarah, or Hagar, and how the relationships that get formed and shaped there can have wide historical impact for centuries and millennia. And so the family is the, often it's viewed as a kind of less significant and area that can be kind of taken for granted. Well, people will always reproduce and, you know, biology kind of takes care of itself with those sexual instincts and mating instincts. But if the family gets cultivated and strengthened, and if there's kind of an awakening of the spirituality of in marriage and the spirituality of the family, and how the family, even before the temple, synagogue, church, is the house of worship, is the place where God should dwell. And Reverend Moon's vision, if that happened, and this is, again, the ideal of the blessing, if that happened, then that gets multiplied, and you reach a critical mass of such families, and particularly you have families that have kind of intermarried, or even if they are not intermarried across cultural, religious, national lines, but they have moved in their own consciousness beyond ethnocentrism and being racially centric or nationally centric or even faith centric in the sense of only my faith can yield salvific results.
But you bring up so many points. Here in the West, in our culture, perhaps marriage has been considered something we can try on and throw off. And we have an enormously high divorce rate, but perhaps folks don't understand entering into it what it is. The calling or vocation that it is.
Exactly.
And, you know, that Reverend Moon, you know, was drawn to Jesus and had that kind of experience. Well, that's what Jesus said in his time, too, where, you know, women could not initiate divorce, but there was a lot of divorce based on this reason or that reason or didn't have children or whatever. And, Jesus in his time pointed out, you can't do this because marriage is a spiritual union.
That's right.
And changes, it just changes the framework of it. that it's somehow sacred at its core, and that that is a that is something to take seriously.
Absolutely, and once again, you know, the as a society becomes a more materialistic and more individualistic and more, we can say, hedonistic, that it's really about my happiness. And one begins to understand happiness more individualistically and doesn't have this broader sense, kind of horizontally, of the of our interdependence and the wider society, but also kind of vertically over time in history of thinking about, and Reverend Moon will always say, don't just think about your life, think about your lineage. You Western people just think about your immediate moment and
right.
your romantic love and whether it's good or bad. But you need to think for the longer duration of history. What kind of descendants do you want to? And look back to your ancestry and respect them and revere them and their sufferings and their efforts to build a better world and their own aspirations. You are now the in the present, carrying that forward. He says we should live in three-generation families, you know, the grandparents, parents, and children together, that this creates the most stable and secure environment for children. And, you know, nobody wants to be judgmental or holier than thou about anybody that has an unsuccessful relationship. It happens.
Right.
And you certainly don't want to force people into abusive relationships. But
No.
The kind of culture that emerged of open divorce and the kind of celebration and taking it for granted has left behind the children. And the social scientific evidence is there that children basically suffer from the divorce of their parents, and they suffer more from divorce than from marriages that are not ideal.
Right.
You know, often the thing, well, we are arguing all the time, it's better if we go our separate ways. And I think you said it, there's not enough preparation for the vocation of marriage, not enough education. You know, people tend to think, particularly in the West, with the view of romantic, oh, I'm just going to magically find Mr. Right or Miss Right, and we're going to be blissfully and, you know, we'll always be having sex together, and it's just wonderful, like in the movies. But
right.
it's not like that.
No.
And it's a serious commitment. And Reverend Moon's also a believer in the tradition of arranged marriages that were widely practiced in traditional Asian societies in particular, that the romantic model has its beauty and benefits, and a lot of great poetry and music and art have emerged out of both the wonders of love and the disappointments of love, but that often greater stability came over time through certain practices of parents recommending spouses to their children. But I think this concept of the vocation of marriage, of preparation for marriage, knowing that it's they're going to be very difficult times, to be ready for that. And this doesn't happen very, very well in our society. Hence, where you get this modernization, which is often understood in political, economic terms that move away from traditional society and traditional values that were often rooted in religion, then divorce rates skyrocket. This is true in America, and it's true in Korea. In just in a short period of time, in the last 30 years or so, the divorce rate have skyrocketed as it becomes one of the top economies in the world. It's also its cherished family traditions are crumbling in many, many areas. So, and it's a very serious point. And here's an area where we're very much under siege of popular culture. Everything is sold through sex. Sex is becomes a commodity, and it drives everything, and it's kind of preying upon that particular instinct that's not evil or bad in and of itself, but it's dominating the pornography industry, the way in which American movies, and that's part of why Islamic culture is so negative toward the West, because we export
and vice versa.
Yes,
that's very true. Go ahead, share that.
Anyway, just the West has is kind of undermining many traditional values. It's not to say we should live in the Middle Ages,
right,
or that we shouldn't develop and flourishing economies and trade and that, but it doesn't need to be dominated by this kind of sexual sedition.
Right. And beyond that as well, for example, there was an article recently where some Muslim students are being bullied on college campuses because they don't drink.
Yeah.
And whereas we can embrace that and wonder about it, rather than make fun of it and say,
right,
what does that come from and how does that help and is there something I can learn from that?
Right.
So which brings us then back to the organization, to UPF. And what are the objectives of UPF, and can you share some of the work involved, like with the UN?
Sure. We work in four or five core areas. One is interfaith is a key part of our kind of platform of programs, that we promote interfaith dialogue, tolerance, but the goal and objective is moving from dialogue and tolerance to respect and appreciation and cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
Not in syncretism, not where we all agree necessarily, but we do see common ground, and we can begin to work together on the basis of more appreciation of the common ground, respectful of differences, and yet learning from one another. You're finding increasingly, even people today who you ask them what's their religion, it's a little bit like what I was saying about people and their nationality or whatever. If you come from a hybrid couple of an African Brazilian or whatever, you're kind of part of a hybrid race or ethnicity. And even in religion, you're seeing people that say, well, I'm a Christian, but I started learning about Buddhism. I didn't give up Christianity, but I love Buddhism. And
right,
I learned it enriched my Christianity so much that I can no longer just say I'm only this. I feel at home in both. So interfaith, and that is a key to peace, because so many of the trouble spots around the world, whether it's India and Pakistan or Israel and Palestine or even Sunni Shia divisions within Iraq, and you just name it around the world, you'll find Nigeria, that there are religious factors. Now, religion isn't the sole factor in causing conflict,
but it's one of them.
It's a kind of corroborating factor. So interfaith dialogue and cooperation. Secondly, we've discussed that is the importance of marriage and family. We are working in the area of what we call broadly peace and security. That we, as an organization, we are, you could say we definitely lean to what you could call the soft power approach to peace building, that you're shaping and moving and touching hearts and minds. And if we can, through ideas and the thought leadership, we can impact peoples, then we can make a difference. But we also don't want to have our heads in the sand in terms of the kind of more realistic hard power dynamics that are there and are very much a part of the present reality. So when one looks at, say, North Korea developing an atomic weapon or Iran, then yes, in some ways it's about moving hearts and minds, but we also want to understand the hard power dynamics because it's a more comprehensive approach to peace that is very much needed. One of our important areas of work, as you mentioned, is work with the United Nations. We're what's called in United Nations language an NGO, which stands for non-governmental organization. And NGOs have been invited to collaborate with the United Nations since the very beginning. But increasingly, the NGO movement or civil society movement has become more and more important and recognized as significant. So within the UN system, there is an opportunity for an NGO to affiliate with one area of work that the UN calls the Economic and Social Council. So UPF is one of a couple of thousand of NGOs affiliated with the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations in what's called consultative status. So we are very much see ourselves as being in a supporting position to the United Nations and seeking to help the UN fulfill its own mission and purpose, which is really about peace and development.
And is that how Reverend Moon hopes to revitalize the UN, which also, you know, came along just after World War II?
Exactly. He has a deep love. Basically, his life was saved by the UN peace forces during the Korean War. And so the Korean people have great love for America because America kind of led that coalition of 16 nations. He's always held the UN in the highest appreciation and respect. In 2000, both Reverend and Mrs. Moon spoke at the United Nations. And Reverend Moon's statement was that what the United Nations needed at this time was to build within its system an interreligious council. You see, right now the UN is an association of member states. It's fundamentally rooted in the concept of the nation state, going back to the Treaty of Westphalia. You know, that these sovereign states are the primary mover and shapers of history. And so if we bring those member states together, we can get them to work together to solve particularly the problem of war and conflict, but a wide range of problems. But as the world and globalization has emerged, then the phenomenon of what's called non-state actors, and another term that sometimes uses multi-track diplomacy, that it's no longer just governments that are shaping and shaking history.
Right.
So when we see the Arab Spring occurring, it's not governmental. And the community, the society of interested people involved go beyond national boundaries. And this is, you know, sometimes referred to as international civil society, et cetera.
Right.
And religion is a transnational movement as well. If you're Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu, or, you know, they're dispersed throughout the globe. So they're kind of global communities. They're not bound by the principle of national sovereignty. So Reverend Moon said, basically, that the UN needs a more holistic approach and cannot really have the kind of vision that it needs without the input of religion. Religion, you know, you don't create a crude theocracy at the UN by bringing in religion, but you bring people of different faith backgrounds who collaborate, work together with the representatives of the member states at the United Nations, along with the civil society and NGOs at the United Nations. And then you get a more holistic approach to problem solving. And I think this is something that there is growing awareness of. So even 10 years after he gave that speech at the UN, at a time when it was kind of, you know, this is viewed as too outlandish or too radical. But 10 years later to the year, the UN General Assembly passed something called the World Interfaith Harmony Week. So, for example, just this past February, the first week of February, the World Interfaith Harmony Week, sponsored by the United Nations, was convened. And there was a major program at the General Assembly. UPF worked together with a number of NGOs and the Office of the President of the General Assembly to organize this program. So it's a concept that religion can no longer be viewed as a threat and a menace to the world, which is how it has been kind of portrayed by nation states. And rightfully so in some respect, because religions or believers of all faiths have acted reprehensibly again and again. Narrow, sectarian, dogmatic, violent, you know, not all, but it's been enough to make them unwelcome. So what's necessary is for religions to kind of reach their own maturation. Because the essence of their teachings are the gems and diamonds of you know, kind of spiritual history and human wisdom, and they shouldn't be lost by flawed believers who select and just practice what their own personal emotions or personalities.
Very well said. Thank you so much, Thomas. We're coming to the end of the program now, and I just wanted to let listeners know that all your website info, which is upf.org, contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at godspeedinstitute.com. I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I'll be interested in learning more in the future.
Well, It's been a pleasure, and I really appreciate you, Care, and the Godspeed Institute, and you taught me what Godspeed means. May God help you prosper.
That's right. That's right, and we try to live that every day with whoever's in front of us, because for us, that's where the mission field begins, with whoever is in front of us. So thank you so much.
I'm order a copy of your book.
Oh, good.
which I saw advertised on your website.
Looking forward to that, too. Now, right. Before we officially close the program today, I wanted to share a weekly tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. And since we've been talking a lot about marriage in the program, and this is, you know, where people are preparing for the big day, the wedding day, I just wanted to share thoughts here, and here's a quote. Every rite of passage both links and divides the past and future. It is like an airlock, and the symbolic journey through this airlock ushers us into an enlargement of spirit. It is one of the hallmarks of it that there is no way back. Growth cannot be ungrown. The old ways have become impossible. The airlock is a one-way passage, so it is a true death and a genuine rebirth through which we enter a new relationship with our own story. This is by Frances Teresa, author of This Living Mirror. And the reason I bring it up is that when we embark on our own journey into love and marriage, we too cross a threshold and move forward into a new life in a new way. I would encourage couples to meet it wholeheartedly, attempting to retain our former life and identity, even in very small ways. Who we were when we were single may diminish our new life and intimacy with our partner. The way to divine love is to surrender to the new life that love calls for. Trust the invitation of the threshold, that it is the manner and way of all growth and life throughout creation. Allow yourselves to be recreated together as a new entity in love. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. Our guest was Thomas Walsh, and the show was produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. We are completely self-supporting, and this program is funded by listeners like you. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed on your journey.